Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everyone and welcome to this special podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best? Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
And today we have Darren Cox, who is the architect of the GT Academy Gamator Racer program and the former head of Nismo, which was Nissan Motorsport. And Darren is here to talk about a number of things and a number of anecdotes. I'm sure we'll drop in people falling out of grandstands and stuff like that. But Darren's
here. No, I can't tell that one again.
Oh, really? Oh dear, that'll have to go in the extras. Darren's here mostly to talk about what's been happening in the World Endurance Championship and sports cars recently, because there's been a seismic change, and then another seismic change, and then another seismic change. So Darren's here to kind of deconstruct and demystify what's been going on, because he's effectively, well, he has been an insider. He knows how the FIA works. He knows how the World Endurance Championship works. So he's the man to talk to. And I'm pleased as well that Jack Phillips is here, because Jack is probably among the motorsport team the guy who knows more about sports car racing in the World Endurance Championship than anyone. So welcome to you, Jack. You all right?
Yeah.
And I shall lean on Jack then, yeah. For those gaps in my knowledge.
I'm going to just take a step back and let you two converse. And we've got Alan. Thanks, Alan, for recording us, as ever. But let's just dive straight in. What is going on with the World Endurance Championship at the moment, the rules and global sports car racing?
Well, I think on the surface, if you read the headlines, global sports car racing looks to be in disarray. But actually what it is we're in a cycle of manufacturers changing their investment strategies. And this isn't new. You know, readers of Motorsport magazine would have seen this a number of times. But if you take the global picture for sports car racing, it's very, very healthy.
Yeah.
If you look at IMSA with the DPI program, if you look at the great job that the SRO with Stefan Rattel is doing on GT3, you look at some of these big new landmark blue ribbon races, yeah, that are getting a huge amount of support, whether that be Bathurst 12 hours or some of the races in the Middle East. You know, Dubai 24 hours has been going a while now, and there's others popping up here and there. We talked earlier about the Suzuka 10 hours, which is new to the calendar, plus other series like Super GT carries on. So sports car racing generally is very, very in a very, very healthy position. But we're just in that position where big manufacturers at one moment can't spend enough money in a series, and the next minute they're not spending anything. And this boom and bust cycle is something that Le Mans has had going back a number of years. I guess the issue is no one saw it coming. And they should have done. You know, this is not unusual. This was probably predictable, and they haven't seen it coming and made the right changes at the right time to ensure that there was a smooth transition.
Did we not see it coming? Because the rumours were, even 3 years ago, that Audi was pulling out, Porsche was likely to follow. Is the blame maybe at the FIA and ACO's door, the fact that they didn't have a plan B, as has been shown recently with the flood of various slightly strange statements coming out that there was no plan B, there was no backup.
Well, I think that's the problem. There's, since the announcement, there's been a plan B, plan C, plan D, which is what you were mentioning, Nick. And I think that chopping and changing of plans, it doesn't do anyone any benefit. And I'm sure a lot of it is to try and keep Toyota for as long as possible. Part of that was to get Peugeot, which I'm sure we're going to touch on the statements that were made at that point about Peugeot looking like they're not going to come back to Le Mans. But actually, if you peel this off the surface, you've got a plan. There was a plan there, which was they knew that they needed more privateers, and they put a privateer plan in place. And there are privateers out there, including Ginetta, that will be running LMP1 cars next year. Now, is that what the fans want? Is that what the series needs? That's a completely different question. But there is a replacement for those big budget LMP1 projects that are in the plan and in the hopper.
I think that is an important question, though, isn't it? How important is or are the manufacturers to the LMP1 class in particular? Can the LMP1 class have its full glory with Ginettas and not Porsche?
The problem is the rules. You know, we all love an underdog, don't we? And, you know, one of my favourite Le Mans campaigns was, if you actually go back, Audi was racing itself. The privateers had half a shot. You know, if Audi had problems, the privateers were there, or they certainly could get on the podium if one of the Audis fell over. Mm. And I remember, you know, Roll Centre Racing, Martin Short, you know, that fantastic story. They should have been on the podium, should have, would have, could have, of course. But, you know, that was the brilliant underdog story against Audi. And there was no one else, it was Audi. So, you know, this isn't new. We've just had a very, very high peak that at one point there was four manufacturers in LMP1, and now there might be one or none. So it's all about just smoothing that curve out, and that's not something that's happened before. But to answer your question, something else will have to happen. On its own, having a Dallara badged as a Russian Banks car versus a Ginetta is not going to fire everyone up as much as, you know, Porsche versus Audi versus Toyota.
Yeah.
Also, an LMP2 beating a Ginetta doesn't have the same story, the same fairy tale as Pescarolo beating Audi. That's a problem as well for the ACO, because in twofold, really, because A, that, like, that's not a story, and also the LMP2s are, what, 800,000? That's the engine for the Ginetta, and then you've got 1.2 million or so to pay out for the car, so why would you do the privateers? The balance isn't there yet, I don't think.
And there should have been a balance. I think, you know, there was an opportunity to balance out the privateers 3 years ago. You know, the privateers could not get anywhere near the manufacturers. Even if you had the best privateer with a massive budget, the rules were written in a way that you were always going to be 20 laps down at the end of Le Mans. Now, you know, it would be great if you had manufacturers there to go toe-to-toe with the privateers. That hasn't happened. So then we haven't got these hero privateers coming up. That then become the heroes themselves that then can be taken on by the new challengers. So we haven't got a story curve. You lost some good independent LMP1 teams, you know, that have gone down to LMP2, for example, as Rebellion have. And then you've got to feed the funnel again. So, you know, I know there's a lot of questions. Well, do we really want this new LMP1? Should we not just have LMP2 as a top class? But it's the same difference. Mm. It's basically spec engines, which I think is also a problem. We can go back to that if you want. And you know, four chassis that no one really cares about in terms of brands and liveries. And to a certain extent, drivers that no one cares about. Because, you know, those drivers that, you know, became the stars of Le Mans, whether it be your Buemis or your Hartleys or Webbers, you know, they're not going to be there anymore unless something dramatic happens. You know, that talent pool is going to move into different championships. And we hear about Hartley going to IndyCar and others moving to other championships. So, yeah, there's not the heroes, whether they be the brands or the people at the top of the class.
I'd be quite binary about it, because my level of knowledge isn't the same as yours. So I was at Donington on Tuesday for a kind of a private track day, and I think I saw 4 or 5 956, 962s. Has there ever been an opportunity for the rulemakers to force manufacturers to build and sell chassis to other teams? And would that have de-risked the scenario that we've got now? Why won't Porsche sell? Why didn't Audi sell their cars when they pulled out the championship? Why won't Porsche build customer LMP1 cars when they have one of the world's greatest customer sports car programs in the world? From your inside knowledge, why not?
I read an article the other day that said that the Porsche LMP1 was probably the most complex racing car ever produced.
Yeah.
If you think about current day Formula One cars, everyone's moaning that they're too complicated with the various hybrid systems on them, but then add four wheel drive and electric motors on top of that, it's got to run for 24 hours and you've got a Porsche LMP1 car. You know, that thing was massively complicated. You know, the Porsche factory with hundreds of millions of dollars couldn't get it to the end of the race all the time. So how could the guy who's, you know, and you look back at these stories of the 962s and whatever, it was a band of weekend warriors with a few pros in there, but they could still run those cars because they were reliable and they were relatively simple. Then go back, try and think about running a diesel Audi and all the complications with it within that. So I just think that the cars are too complex for the privateers to run. I mean, this is a class when people stopped using an LMP2 turbo engines because, you know, that was too difficult in terms of heat rejection and everything else. So everyone wanted a big lump V8 in the back. So then try and run something as complicated as a Porsche. So I think times have moved on. I don't think that there was ever a chance of that happening. There was rumblings when Audi pulled out, but that would have been a pseudo Audi program, as we've seen in the past with Champion and others. I think that wasn't a route that was ever open to anybody.
Yeah.
At Spa, in the 6 hours, there was a support race for the Endurance Legends. The most recent car was a 908.
Yes.
And that had probably 10, 15 Peugeot shirts around it at all times, keeping it going and alive and getting it onto track. But then there was a car, there was an R8, which is, what, maybe 8 years older. Mm. That was just a man on a laptop plugging into an IBM Windows 95 laptop.
And then there was Martin Short with him and his mates running that Dallara to circle the story. Yeah.
And another question, it's kind of around how we seem to have on the road car side cars that have got close to being prototype level racing cars, and yet there's never been a point where the rule makers have looked at LaFerrari's, Koenigseggs, Pagani's, Bugatti, Chiron's and Veyron's and thought, well, maybe that's the future of our championship. And I know that, say, for instance, the McLaren P1, the structure, the mono cell or mono cage, whatever it is actually homologated for racing, but it's never raced. Was that ever tabled in your experience that there would be a hypercar class that would eventually move into sports car racing?
I know Dickie Meaden wrote a really good piece about that, actually, and saying that that should be, and it'll never make it as a racing driver.
No.
That was never discussed. Right. What you've got to think about is at the time I was sat around the table, the ACA were on top of the world. You know, they had, at that point, four manufacturers in place. You know, let's be honest, Audi were hosing money at this thing, both on and off track. They basically kept the WEC running. So that's another conversation to be had. You had Porsche spending a lot of money on hospitality. We were doing our own promotions in a different way. And Toyota were there as well, not spending marketing money, but, you know, as part of the setup. So they didn't need anything else. This was the guys that they needed to keep happy around the table. And they certainly were keeping, you know, Audi happy. You know, they'd been there a long time. They clearly were in the pound seat. They were the ones that, you know, discussed the rules first. Audi had a guy full-time, absolutely full-time. His only job was rules. But what does that mean? Of course, it only takes so long to read the rule book and, you know, work out how it is and give that to the rest of the engineers. He was thinking about, what's the rules for next year? How are we going to change it? What's the rules for 5 years? What's the rules for 10 years? Let's have lunch with the ACO in Paris and discuss that. That was his one job. And of course, that resource for a small body like the ACO is fantastic. You know, they can lean on those sort of guys. So, but at that time, no, there was never any conversation. And, you know, I've heard it being said that, well, why don't we have the GT class, GTE as the top class at Le Mans? That would be seen as a massive retrograde step. You know, what would you then do with the LMP2 cars, for example? You then restrict them down to be slower than GT and let GTE off the leash. You know, the guys that have been at Le Mans are expecting a car to come past them at, you know, 300 and something clicks, and then suddenly everything's slowed down. You know, we would certainly feel that. But that wasn't discussed. And I honestly think that prototypes, for as long as we can, should be part of the mix of Le Mans. It's always been so. But GTEs need to have their own place and need to have the focus of the ACO in certain other areas. So, for example, something, you know, that was discussed when I was there, and an idea I had that's been sort of changed a little bit, which is, why not have a GTE race on the Saturday, yeah, specifically for them and with championship points? Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Why not? You know, gives them something that they can talk about. They're not just being overtaken by, you know, privateer-driven LMP2 cars.
And you'd have, you know, 60 of them, you know, or 70 of them, as, you know, watching VLNs at the Nürburgring and seeing so many of these cars, or at Bathurst, you know, that would be a hell of a spectacle. Mm-hmm. So a quick question back to your time at Nissan and Nismo. Did you see the stability? Well, you obviously saw the stability in the championship when you decided to commit to it, or was there still any doubt over the long-term future? I mean, you, when you went in with Nissan, you went in.
Yeah. It was this could be a long. This could be a long conversation.
Well,
couldn't
I had to drop it in.
Yeah. No. And it's fine. And yeah, of course, we thought it was there was long term stability there. You know, our assumption would be that VW Group would continue to support it. There was always this: would both brands be there in the long term? But right. I think that was very quickly confirmed to us that would be the case, that they would support it. So yeah, we thought there was long term stability, and there was an article I wrote, and I can't remember if it's for this current amazing magazine or the rubbish one I used to write for, about the fact that, you know, one decision could have such a big impact, i.e., people deciding that they were going to allegedly cheat the emissions. Mm. If you actually just look back at what's happened to Le Mans, that decision has had a massive knock-on effect, yeah, and also basically cemented Formula E as the place to be for manufacturers. So it's that law of unintended consequences that happens. And who knew that would have happened? If that decision wouldn't have been taken by a group of people, everyone, you know, there wasn't one rogue engineer, was it?
No.
Then we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'm sure at least one of the two brands would still be racing long-term at Le Mans, if not both of them. So we couldn't see that coming, obviously. So we thought it was secure. But what we did, and you know, there's a whole conversation and probably a book in it somewhere about what we did, but we knew we couldn't come in and build an Audi copy or a Porsche copy. Mm-hmm. We had to do something different because they were spending, in effect, too much money on this championship. You know, we couldn't derive the marketing benefit out of it by spending 350 million. There was no way that the championship would allow you to get a multiple of 350 million. You might as well go and spend it on the Champions League. Guess what's happened? Nissan are now spending money on the Champions League because they can work out, if I spend £1 here, I'll get £3 back in terms of value. That's not the case in WEC. So we went a different route. This is what we think we can get in terms of value. This is our budget. What can we do? Well, to take these guys on, we're going to have to do something completely different. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. So, that's why we ended up with a front-engined LMP1 car.
How much potential was in that car? What did you see that maybe the rest of us didn't?
You're now unwinding months and months of psychiatric treatment, Nick.
Oh, dear. But,
nurse? Well, you know, in the biggest mistake, again, you talk about law of unintended consequences. A bloke called Andy Palmer left Nissan and went to Aston Martin. I don't know what's happened since he's gone there. But
they've done all right.
It was his project. The LMP1 project was one of many projects that he was involved in, and therefore the air cover for the people that were running that project, i.e. me and Ben Bowlby, was gone. So we then went back to what I would state is a normal big company corporate structure.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't the air cover that you get from an enthusiastic, knowledgeable executive
figurehead
at the top, which we've seen the change that Andy's made at Aston, quieter but still the same. Carlos Tavares, who also moved from the Renault Nissan group over to Peugeot Citroën, completely changed that business round. So if you've got someone like that, you know, you can have the air cover and you can progress with seemingly crazy stuff like that. Obviously, we didn't jump into it with our eyes closed. There were simulations done. The simulations were positive. But let's forget that, because engineers can make stuff up and tweak a number here and, you know, change the tyre model, and suddenly you've got a Porsche beating car for a few million quid. Just before Le Mans, I mean, our mistake was, I guess, because Andy had gone, we had to get the car on track.
Right. You know,
there was no way of, if he was still there, maybe we could have delayed it a year. But the biggest mistake, I guess, was continuing with the hybrid system we had. We should have had a fullback place. So in the end, we ended up with a front-wheel drive car. We would have been better off, you know, cutting our losses early and either deciding not to run with the hybrid a lot earlier or trying to find an electric equivalent. Yeah. Or a delaying year. But we went to America, the Corvette the testing facility, which has now just gone completely out of my head. Through that psych. It's really worked.
The analysis.
Just forget all of that. Forget all of that. You don't need to think about it. Think nice, shiny lights. Exactly. And something bowl. It will come to me in a minute.
Yeah.
And, it's basically, Corvette have set it up to be a mini Le Mans, without the straight. So you've got the equivalent of the Porsche curves, you've got the chicanes and everything else. So we were testing there, and I bought an LMP2 car over, flew it over in Le Mans spec from Greaves Motorsport. So it won Le Mans. It was the tyres, everything was exactly the same as Le Mans. So I could see if these simulations worked or not. We'd have back-to-back data across the two cars, and I could see with my own eyes, you know, that this car was going to be quick or not. When they're on track, it's not difficult. We had, you know, a reasonable driver drive it, Harry Tinknell, who was won a few championships in P2 at that time, and go out and do some laps. The LMP1 car was 5 seconds a lap faster around that circuit with a lot less straights. And of course, the LMP1 car was a lot quicker down the straights. Yeah. So even with my small brain, without you know, a myriad of algorithms for a simulation, the car was quick enough. And literally we boxed that car up. Yes, of course, there were still reliability issues, et cetera, et cetera. We boxed that car up, and somewhere we lost, in the mid-Atlantic, we lost about 25 seconds. That car, based on that data, just, you know, a very simple simulation, if you just extrapolate the lap time, plus getting all that data and putting it into two separate simulation tools, we were doing low 20s. 3 minute 20s, which would have put us exactly. So Gary Watkins, who occasionally puts some stuff into your fantastic magazine, asked me, and he reminds me to this day, so you're going to be quicker than the LMP2s. And I think I used an expletive. Expletive. Yes, of course we are, Gary. We wouldn't be here. And we weren't. So that wasn't me giving, you know, if I knew we were going to be slower than the LMP2 cars, we wouldn't have come. We wouldn't have gone to Le Mans. So in a way, it's still sort of, I still question what happened. I mean, there was suspension issues, so the guys were off the curbs. You know, maybe the curbs were, you know, more severe at Le Mans than we expected, as we were breaking rear suspension and et cetera. Then, you know, we lost time on track. It was rain. I mean, you know, you go through all those things, but, you know, essentially, yeah, we somewhere lost 20 seconds versus the simulation, which is crazy. And then you're dead at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think I've said this publicly, what I'm about to say, but I basically wrote a 10-point plan. This is how we can fix it the days after Le Mans, and not everyone agreed to that 10-point plan. So I suggested that someone else take on the project, and I'll go and do my own thing. So that took 6 months of conversations for me to leave Nissan. They didn't want me to leave, but I knew, you know, that was always going to be, you know, a sticking point. That, you know, I wanted the LMP1 program to go in a different direction than it did, with a certain way of getting out the issue. And then, you know, 3 months after I left the camera, the project was canned.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there ever a thought on, say, Wednesday afternoon at Le Mans to think maybe we should pack up?
No, because again, if you remember that year, it was raining on Wednesday. Everyone was saying that the track conditions were really difficult. It was green. So, no, there was always a, hang on a minute, you know, we'll be all right, we'll be all right. You know, we had a bad test session, we were, you know, 2 weeks previous. But then we hired the Bugatti circuit. The car went, you know, really quick round there. So, yeah, it's still, you know, there was a lot of bigger brains in the garage than me, and they still can't work out what happened. So, yeah, the book could be called The Lost 20 Seconds or something, couldn't it?
You should serialise it in a motor racing magazine.
That's not a bad idea.
Nick Mitchell asked, effectively, you've just answered the question that Nick
Mitchell asked us, so thanks, Nick, for the question. Although he did add something.
It's one of my pseudonyms, actually. I just asked myself questions.
Did you ask all of these questions? Yeah. You need more analysis, I think, if you're asking yourself questions. whose idea was it to... He uses the word alienate. Whose idea was it to alienate a load of fans by having a static car on display at Silverstone in the Manchester City Football Club colours? I never understood the thinking behind that.
Well, I'd forgotten about that one. Well, we were supposed to be at the WC round at Silverstone, and actually it was the complete opposite idea. The idea was we can't be there in reality, so we will take one of our spare cars, show car, sorry, which we built, I think, 3 show cars, you know, which was quite a commitment at that point, and proved also we weren't just in it for 1 year. This was supposed to be a long-term program. And if anyone that was at Silverstone remembers, we opened the garages. I mean, we got a huge amount of praise, actually, from a lot of fans for doing that. We couldn't be there. Massive apologies. Sorry, fans, but come and see us in the garage. And sit. We had kids sitting in the cars, people taking pictures of the people in the cars, really trying to be open. Maybe it was the Man City thing. But at the time, Nissan were corporate partners of Man City, and we did some promotion around it. And in my experience, if you co-promote 2 sports or 2 things together, you get fans from both of those things that work together. So the idea was maybe Man City fans would come and sort of be interested in Le Mans.
Yeah,
I'm all about trying to get more fans into our sport, and that was one thought. I guess the red side of Manchester or maybe even London, where United fans might be, didn't appreciate the city colours on the car.
Sure.
Marketing was the big success of Nissan. I thought that whole program it put Le Mans into the eyes of a very different demographic. But is there a case that maybe it went too loud too soon, that it may have been better off sliding in under the radar with this, wow, look at this?
Jack should do this more often. He's done the whole chat show hosting. give me a little bit of praise and then kick me in the balls.
It's good cop, bad cop in one.
Yeah,
it was a great question. As I believe the Americans say, great question, Jack.
Buying time.
Yeah, twice. And that though, I was going to say, when you gave the positive bit at the beginning, I was going to say actually, even someone from the ACO said that you're doing too much marketing, which I would think that a promoter and someone that's in the sport would want more and more promotion. And I think the summary at the beginning was absolutely spot on. We went out to get a different demographic. The American guys decided to do a Super Bowl ad in the middle of the Super Bowl featuring the LMP1 car. That was our launch. So there was a whole bunch of people watching the Super Bowl that suddenly reminded about Le Mans, and I'm trying to think about it again because I haven't thought about it in a long time. Did we go too much too soon? No, I don't think we did. I think, here was what I said at the time, so maybe I just refer back to that because I was thinking about it a lot more. The reason we stood out for doing a lot of marketing and perceived as being aggressive was because no one else does marketing particularly well in motorsport. There you go, there's a sweeping statement for you. I can count that my hand how many pieces of motorsport marketing I've been impressed with that have been left field. Mm-hmm. Star Wars with Red Bull in Monaco. Mm-hmm. BAR putting a car in a, I mean, there's a lot of BAR stuff, by the way. Mm-hmm. Putting a car in a swimming pool, hanging a car up by its component parts.
Mm-hmm. Even the zip livery.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah, there's a whole load of stuff there. And now I need to look down the camera and go, whoever did that is a genius. that is an in-joke, that one. And, Audi spent a lot of money on WEC and Le Mans, but what did they do? They did traditional stuff. They got a load of people along, had a fantastic time, by the way. They got a lot of people along to Le Mans, opened eyes, I guess, to Le Mans. They did TV ads when they won. They did, I think, one thing they did which was pretty cool, which was McNish doing the what's it like to be a Le Mans driver. But it was traditional marketing. Mm. And I think the reason why we might have rubbed people up the wrong way was we actually did some marketing and we did it in a disruptive way. And I still get people, maybe one of the questions is, why did you have a slide in your hospitality unit at Le Mans? Because why not? Mm. Have a bit of fun. We all remember a Red Bull F1 team when they were fun. right? They used to have the jumping loudest in music, swimming pools, jumping in swimming pools, having the Star Wars guys doing crazy stuff. Now they're just another racing team that, you know, wins a lot, but doesn't do the marketing. And I think you've got to have that type of mental approach. So what absolutely is not the case was it wasn't a marketing program that was going racing. And I, you know, I took, there was this German guy, journalist, who was completely anti us, of course. And he was standing outside our garage. And I saw him. So I said, come in. He says, are you sure? I said, yeah, just come in. Come and have a look around. He says, well, I'm not even allowed in the Audi garage. I said, no, come and have a look around. And he couldn't believe the amount of effort we were putting into that program. He had written that this is just a marketing stunt. Then he comes in. We've got 3 sets of bodywork per each car ready out the back. We've got, I don't know how many people we had, because we were bringing people in, you know, all the time to catch up. We had, I don't know, 120 people on site working on the cars to get that ready. And he went out of there and said, I take back what I said. This is a proper racing effort. And everyone in that garage, you look at anybody in that garage, they're racers. I mean, you know, next weekend, I was just saying to Jack, I'm doing a Spa 24 Hours, for example. I'll leave that hanging. You know, Ben Bowlby, you know, a racer at heart, you know, Ricardo Davila, you know, you know, unrivaled background as an engineer. There wasn't people in there that are not racers, that are corporate suits in there going, right, just make sure you get our brand across, guys. It wasn't. It was make that car go faster.
Why didn't anyone continue the work that you'd started on the marketing side, not Nismo or Nissan, but Porsche or Audi or Toyota? Because it felt like, when I was there at Silverstone, for instance, and there were kids climbing in and out of the car, all I could think about was me as a 6-year-old getting on Barry Sheen's bike at a bike show. And this was one of the most inspirational things ever, you know. But then when I went back after you guys had left, the doors were still pretty much closed, really, for a Porsche and Audi. It must be depressing, surely, that nobody picked up on what you were doing.
Well, it's like I
took the baton, you know.
I wrote a piece for you guys recently, talking about, you know, the experience at Silverstone as a Grand Prix, and I think Liberty will make some big changes, and they'll make a positive impact on the sport. But at the moment, their F1 experiences is a bunch of celebrities and execs driving around in two seats.
Yeah,
well, that's no good for the fans, apart from the fact there's a load of noise, which is because I think they're V10s, aren't they?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, just it's just a mentality thing. And I go back, and I was having a bit of bants on Twitter last night, that Karun Chandhok was quoted saying, a great way of coming into motorsports through esports. Well, I said, well, someone should have thought of that. And what I put afterwards was, I'm still surprised no one's done another GT Academy. I mean, it's obvious. Why hasn't anyone done that? So I guess it's, and we went to Porsche, we went to some LMP1 marketing meetings, and I didn't go to all of them. You know, one of my team went, but the Porsche guys going, oh, we love what you do. It's fantastic. Well done. We could never get away with that. It's just a corporate culture, isn't it, that happens. You get corporate culture of Red Bull at the time. They're doing all that crazy stuff, was go and do crazy stuff. BAR was go and do crazy stuff. We've got a lot of fag money. How can we spend it, literally? We were, you know, we can't spend money on media. I'll give you an example, just in terms of how it worked. We had a massive marketing campaign set up. I mean, like, blow anyone away. And at the last minute, it was cut. And my boss said, which of course then wasn't Andy, you can spend the money you bring in. So all we could spend was the sponsor money. So that wasn't Nissan money spent on the marketing. All the Nissan money went on the car. The Super Bowl ad, that was different. That was an advertising budget from America. Yeah. But all the money that was in our hands on that project, that was Nissan's money, went on making the car go faster. Yeah. So, but I to answer your question, I think it's...
Is it top down again? Does it need an Andy Palmer? It needs
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, you know, that, as you know better than anyone, Nick, you know, the media world's changing, and I think more and more people are going to have to do this. It is easy to put an ad in the Telegraph the following day after you win a race and tick a box, because your CEO reads that paper, so he sees it. To try and do what we've just discussed at Silverstone, letting people in the car or whatever, it's like, well, what value did I get out of that? Well, I don't know how to measure it, boss. Okay, well, that's a bit of a waste of time. So there is that mentality, and it is just, it's fear of failure as well, isn't it? To do this sort of stuff, you've got to try it. But it's not just the teams, it's not just the manufacturers, it's also some of the events as well, as we talked about. I think a massive missed opportunity. I was speaking to someone about rallycross this morning, You know, Ken Block's not in rallycross.
Yeah.
In Europe or whatever they whatever it's called, the world. That's a massive missed opportunity. Mm. Why didn't rallycross do more with Ken Block? He gets millions and millions of views of what he does. Why wasn't there that crossover of Ford that doing it or IMG or Block and his team himself to make that crossover? So the numbers didn't stack, so they pulled out. So yeah, there's. I mean, you guys think about it. What the shining examples of motorsport where you go, that's a brilliant piece of marketing. That's a great piece of promotion that will help our sport, because it was almost dirty. What you're marketing this? You're doing PR around it. Mm. You know, people sort of. But that's the whole point, is to push our sport forward. Because, and the example I use is Nitro Circus. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah,
but a bunch of crazy dudes jumping stuff in indoor arenas.
Saw a guy in a wheelchair do a backflip.
Yeah, and they do it in shopping trolleys. And
yeah.
I mean, they're just
those little micro scooters. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
that. When I was a kid, my dad took me to Brands Hatch, and my Nitro Circus was a club race where a wheel fell off the car and nearly hit my brother on the head as it came across the fence. And, you know, it was wet and windy and the food was rubbish, but that was the entertainment that was available. Now we can go to the O2, sit in our nice comfy chair, order our supersize Diet Coke and popcorn, watch a bunch of crazy blokes with fireworks and loud music do that. So entertainment's changed. So motorsport's got to change with it, and I don't think that we have. So I just ask that question. What do you think, what's the best piece of marketing, non-Nissan GT Academy type of thing, that you two have seen?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel too close to it. I'm not sure if I can pick one thing out, but I'd identify a theme that is being ignored, I think, by most organisers. And that's the idea of reminding adults what it was like when they were kids and they were first starting to get into motorsport, and reminding people just how pure that experience is of being a kid and climbing on Barry Sheen's bike or even seeing your hero, you know, in a paddock. We've kind of forgot that, and it's the long term gains you get for that. I mean, I can still trace back my passion for motorsport to those tiny little moments, and I didn't climb in an LMP1 car. You know, if I probably would have fainted if I was given the chance to get in a 956 or something like that. So first of all, I think manufacturers should just kind of filter out a lot of the crap and the BS that goes on, and just think, what would a 6, 7, 8 year old be really excited about? What would I have been excited about? And then lay it on, you know, during the weekend's activities. And then I think, I mean, we're obviously going to go on to esports, but what we've got at the moment in the modern age is the opportunity to inspire the next generation of motor racing enthusiasts via gaming, which we didn't have, you know, when we were kids. And I think it's naive to poo-poo the kind of the opportunity that there is with esports to trigger that, what will ultimately be a lifetime passion for the sport. Most people get into motor racing, don't get in and get out. You get in and you're there until the day you pop your clocks, you know. So, I can't identify one apart from the glorious work at Nismo during the... I was going to say the Calsonic era of R32 GTRs, actually. But I do admire the work you did then. But Jack, you're 50 years younger than I am.
Well, I remember my first race event I went to, I sat in a Mini 7, I think, Mini Melia. And that was incredible when I was sort of 6 years old, 5 years old. And that's just a little Mini. And I remember there was a pink car with yellow spots, which obviously is a six-year-old. That's Mr. Blobby. So
my that, Lord.
A club race assessment.
I need to
it's
send you a
takes.
Picture of my dad's rallycross car, which was a Mini.
Really?
And the colour scheme on it.
May have been the same. But then...
yellow with black spots.
I actually think Red Bull is actually doing quite a good job with Max Verstappen and Daniel Ricciardo.
Yeah, no, that's
right
a fair
now
point.
Because
that is a fair point.
They are making them what they are, which is a normal 20-something having the time of their lives, racing caravans behind an Aston Martin. That puts us into their shoes.
You're absolutely right.
And it's not false. Yeah. That's
no,
it. It's not.
They are both having a laugh.
They're fortunate in that they've got two guys who you can effectively go, we know you're not going to make some massive corporate, you know, disaster statement. So take a funny selfie of Max on a plane fast asleep, or tow a caravan and crash it, kind of thing. So they're fortunate. Can you imagine any other F1? Is there any other driver in F1 that you could trust to be themselves?
that's another long question. Well,
they're the only two that maybe currently have the persona to do it. Everyone else is so driven to succeed, whereas they can do both.
They're probably the two best prospects on the grid to be world champion. Yeah. It hasn't been yet, so is there something there? While we've been talking, I thought of another one that's a great example, and I can't believe it's not been copied, which is the approach that Lord March takes to Goodwood, generally. Whether you talk marketing, you talk the event itself, the way he monetizes it, the way he's expanded it to, manufacturers now have to be involved. They've now got it's basically the British Motor Show now. So that's another example, but it's a bit too premium. It's not what we're talking about, which is the access points for people. But one of my great memories recently is just standing behind a Lotus 25 behind the exhausts and it starting up and smelling the exhaust. So it's that closeness, isn't it? And that's the problem with F1, isn't it? It's always been about the exclusivity, which puts the barriers in between the fans and the action.
Yeah. Right, okay, we're going to get onto a couple more questions. And
from me?
Yeah, from you. You've got multiple personalities here, Darren. That's a real problem. Stephen Gate, given Nismo in Japan could build a Super GT GTR that could lap Fuji in just 5 seconds slower than a P1 that has better aerodynamics and hybrid power, wouldn't it have been better to utilise their experience with front-engine cars and get them to design the GTR LM Nismo? P.S. This is not Nissan bashing, as I was a huge fan of the car.
I was about to say I recognise the name, so appreciate the... it's not me. appreciate the point. That's a long question. Lots of different rules. And of course, Nismo were fully involved. We had... And the comments about marketing being good, everything behind the garage was down to me. So, including driver signing. So, I'm happy that someone like Harry has continued his career and he'll have a long career. He was a great, not a find. We didn't find him. We identified him doing a great job previously and signed him. I think the driver lineup, with one or two exceptions, pound for pound, was the best. The marketing was great, the PR was great, blah 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 blah. We had five people on the engineering committee, of which, or the racing committee, of which I was one. That's your problem straight away. It was a committee, and that's just the Japanese way of doing things. And if you look at the success that those guys have had in Japan, and it's phenomenal, by the way. We were talking earlier, they might be winning their fourth championship in 5 years. But that is built on years and years and years and years and years of doing the same thing. It's the quote from that I heard the other day from Warren Buffett talking about compounding. It's just about just keep doing the same thing and you get better and better at it. And in the end, all that effort adds up. This wasn't like that. This was, we had to get in quick. There's a window here in terms of the rules. Let's get in and do it quickly. So the knowledge was utilised. To copy that car wasn't necessarily the right way of doing it. So I need a lot longer to answer that question. But fair point. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to jump in?
No, I was just going to say about the attraction of WEC for manufacturers like it appealed to Nissan. Who or why would?
Well, let's be honest. It didn't.
Manufacturer.
It absolutely didn't. It's nothing to do with WEC. It's Le Mans. You get 80% of the value of your investment for 2 weeks at Le Mans. Mm-hmm. The rest of the championship is almost irrelevant in terms of value. And you can see different, people take different approaches to it in terms of the effort. Some of them just use the rest of the championship as a test. Which bodywork are you going to use at Silverstone or Spa? You almost try and think that you want to just get ready for Le Mans. So just from a value point of view, unless you look like you're going to win the championship and then you say, oh, it's the most important thing ever, I think that the issue is that the championship's built potentially in the wrong way, in the fact that, first of all, it's cookie cutter. So, endurance racing has always been about individual character of the races, whether it be Sebring or whether it be, Nürburgring 24 Hours or any of the big races, they've had their own character. What the ACO tried to do was copy the F1 model from 20 years ago, when every race had to be exactly the same, to the same length, to the same process, to the same format. What works in Mexico isn't necessarily, from a sports car race, isn't necessarily going to be the same that works in Japan. There's a massive heritage of sports car racing in Japan, so why not make that race 1,000 kilometres, because that's the length they understand. Go to Sebring and do a 10-hour or 12-hour race, whatever fits there, not having six-hour races just moving around in terms of character. I mean, that's just a small point, but the point is, you know, those other races are shaky. They just so happen to be kept together because of a championship. So I think that's part of the root cause of the problem of this sudden, ta-da, we've got a super series, because actually the WEC struggles to make sense in some respects from a brand point of view, and also from the ACO's commercial point of view as well.
Jack, give us an overview of Super Series and
yes, please, Jack. Explain exactly what that's about.
And two Le Mans 24 hours. And
yes,
give us an overview.
Can I just say one good bit of news in that is Silverstone having an August date.
Oh yes.
That is just genius. I've been saying to Stuart Pringle and the guys up there and the ACO, give Silverstone a date in the summer. And in simple terms, as people are getting on and off the ferries on the way home, here's the Le Mans reunion. It's at Silverstone, free camping. Come along and watch these cars race again. Brilliant. So that's the one positive.
Yeah, I've camped at Silverstone for some of those WEC April races.
You are mad. Next time, come and stay at my house.
It was very cold. but basically, I'm making Le Mans the centrepiece by putting it at the end of the season.
And at the beginning in one of them.
Yes.
I'm literally
so
confused about where we are.
14-month season, the first one. Originally, it had no Silverstone. And then there was outcry, understandably, because this is basically the WEC's biggest, most fervent fan base is in the UK. And to not come to the UK made no sense.
Yeah.
But then that, within maybe a month, was changed, which they then said was for... They span it a little bit, as championships do.
Yeah.
That's what, by saying that Aston Martin will be delighted, and this is for our UK fans. Mm. But basically, the series now starts at Spa, and then going to Le Mans, and then there was a break, no Nürburgring, the couple of flyaways, back to Spa, and then back to Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
That was season one. So it was still a huge expense, but they made it because there were bigger gaps. They could freight cheaper, and they could. It was all this economical. It was made more sense for the manufacturer, supposedly, but it didn't make sense for the fans. So now there's a doubleheader again in August with ELMS, which is always a good event without the weather. So now hopefully it'll be a good event with weather, but probably still wind because it's Silverstone.
So if you won both the Le Mans races...
You had the World Championship because you'd have two double point races.
Yeah.
It's just kind of offering it to Toyota... is a thinly veiled carrot for Toyota. They can finally win them on twice and win the World Championship because they'd have double points.
Except they've done very well at not winning Le Mans.
Yes, but they would in theory be able to go slower because there are no other manufacturers.
Let's go slow to win.
Yes.
That's kind of malfunction over that.
Well, Le Mans used to be like that.
It worked in the 80s.
That's the way it used to be. Read any of Dan Gurney's pieces about Le Mans or... Even Derek Bell to a certain extent at the beginning of where he was. It was about anyway. I'm not saying that should
they
be the way of doing it these
though.
Days. Yeah, no, they had competition. Yes, they were going slow as well as everyone else having to go slow to maintain the cars. But this is an issue, I think, and it will come up, I think, a lot more when the new F1 rules come out as well. The WEC focus very much on the cost cutting, but there's two sides to a balance sheet. Anyone that's worked in a business will tell you. It's not just about cost reduction, it's about the value side as well. And sometimes these decisions are taken, as you just mentioned there, without actually thinking about what value it brings or what value is reduced by whatever it is they're doing. And, I mean, who thought not to put Silverstone on the calendar at that point? I mean, it's just, it's a crazy situation. So I'm glad it's back in. But I think that everyone, and they haven't got much time, but there should be a step back taken and think about the value to the fans, the value to the brands, as well as just wholly focus on cost cutting. And I guess that cost cutting was just to tempt the manufacturers in. But honestly, the difference between freighting all your kit via a ship or an aircraft is not going to make the difference between you deciding on an LMP1 program or not. Bigger decisions about reducing the hybridization or the amount of testing or whatever it might be, that's going to be more important than saving a few hundred grand here and there on shipping or flying kit around. So they need to look at both sides of the balance sheet, basically.
Okay, go on.
Well, that cost was aimed also at Peugeot, wasn't it, who have recently said, well, they haven't said no, but the ACO has basically confirmed that Peugeot won't be coming because they're instead going to rallycross, which is cheap. Obviously, has a you're putting a road car on a gravel track. Fans see it. It's one of the biggest growing sports around. It makes more sense for Peugeot. But Peugeot didn't actually say they weren't coming to Le Mans. But the ACO jumped and put out a slightly bizarre statement saying Peugeot will not be coming and we are looking for, we are open to other manufacturers. But who they are, BMW has been rumoured for years.
But they've committed to GTE.
And the technology's not right.
Yeah.
So who is coming?
Who is coming? Well, actually, if we're going to get the crystal ball out, well, actually, you need to get the crystal ball out. So this is, we're coming towards the end now, but this is where we go into the stuff that maybe makes the traditional motor racing enthusiast feel a little bit uncomfortable. But with your experience and expertise of GT Academy, world's fastest gamer, in 10 years' time, is the world e-motor racing champion going to be more famous and more valuable than the world Formula One champion?
That is a brilliant question I've never thought of, because a minute ago...
work here is done.
A minute ago, everyone thought this was complete nonsense, this gaming stuff, and then suddenly it's you have to think about it in a different light in terms of an alternative to the current physical championships. I'll just go back. If anyone wants to read the statement from the ACO on Peugeot, also look at the one when Audi and Porsche pulled out, and you'll see there is... some narkiness.
We should publish just all three straight, shouldn't we, on the website?
Yes.
Yeah, and just
publish underneath the podcast.
Underneath the podcast. There we go.
Underneath the podcast. There was, I guess, 3 years ago, there's a report that states the 50 top sportsmen of the future in terms of commercial earnings, and one Jan Mardenborough was 50th. So there was a recognition that gaming was a big thing at that point. And if you look at gamers that are playing games that most people that are watching this podcast never heard of, League of Legends, and this type of game, they're earning millions. I mean, these kids are earning millions of dollars through prize money and endorsements and everything else. And it's quite a hidden culture at the moment. We've seen... recently, in the last 18 months, a lot of people dabble in the gaming and esports. One kid won $220,000 in Las Vegas for winning the Formula E event. Formula E could have had a leading position in it. They seem to have sort of walked away from it, but it doesn't seem to be as big a part of their strategy going forward. Now Formula One have jumped in, and the funny thing is, obviously I'm in that space quite heavily, and I've got a team called Esports and Cars, and we've got 22 drivers that are signed to us that are racing all different championships, and we're signing some guys from the F1 game, which wasn't something we were doing because the F1 game's seen as a bit arcadey, and we wanted to sort of be in some of the other spaces. And I'm now, and I literally before I came on, I had a phone call from one of the dads that we're looking at signing this guy, and he's a karting dad. They think that their son's going to be the next big thing, but it's going to be in the esports world. I think this is a few years away from that actually happening, but the momentum is there, absolutely. I hope, because I'm in this space, but I'm a traditionalist, and I'm as you know, I care about the history of our sport, and historic racing is very important as well. I think the rise of historic racing gives us some comfort that there's always going to be those of us out there that will want the real thing to carry on. And yes, we'll all get annoyed that Formula E is suddenly going to be the place where all the manufacturers are. So the industry has to do its job to keep big events like Le Mans and others, really at the forefront of people's minds, even if there's no manufacturers there. We've got to come up with a solution that keeps Le Mans having 250,000 people there, people wanting to watch it live on TV, Indy 500 and all these other races. Otherwise, the sport will nosedive or become fully electric, which I think everyone's very worried about. The answer to your question, I honestly don't know. And even though it would benefit me from a commercial point of view, I hope not. I hope that the way I see esports is very simple. And there's a really great report from America which is talking about And it's an academic study, it's not a marketing study, which is about the Major League Soccer. And the conclusion of this study, which is all about how fast Major League Soccer has grown as a sport in America, their conclusion is one of the key drivers of that speed of growth was FIFA, the game. And it's kids playing on, you know, it's reverse. You and I, when we were younger, we were thrown a football, we kicked a football, and at some point through buying the jersey, going to a match, watching your mates play, playing for your local team, you ended up playing a game of football on a computer or a console back in the day. The kids are doing it completely opposite. They're finding their sports through gaming.
Yeah.
So these kids, and this report states that they are playing FIFA. They know who the left back is at West Ham. So there's a kid in Alabama who's playing as you know the right back for Hull, you know, at the moment on FIFA. And they go backwards. They play the game on the PlayStation or Xbox. They then watch a potentially something on a hacked stream from the Premier League. Yeah. They might then buy the jersey on Amazon. And at some point, after going to a game at the Red Bull, whatever they're called, in America, that they might actually kick a ball. Yeah. So we've got to get our heads. It was something you said right at the beginning. We've got to get our heads around. How are kids finding sport? And if we can think that they're finding sport through a multitude of new driving games. I mean, we've got, you know, three massive new games just come out. Plus, you've got the explosion of mobile games. You know, Real Racing 3 from EA. 380 million people have downloaded that game. There aren't 380 million, you know, motorsport fans around the world. So, despite Bernie's numbers. you know, so we just got to turn our heads around. But for me, I hope that it is in parallel, and the two things aren't compared or one's better than the other. I hope that we can see that the digital world will bring more people into the real world of sport. Whether that means we do another GT Academy, that you find drivers there or not, I think it has to happen, because kids are racing on simulators and you know, karting's getting more and more expensive. But for me, it's the other side, it's the fans. You know, I talk to, I mean, you know, again, using Dickie Meaden, you know, people get excited about certain cars because they played them in Gran Turismo 1. Why is the Calsonic blue Super GT car that Jan Mardenborough drives so iconic? Because we all drove it in Gran Turismo.
Yeah.
So we've just got to put our mind in that. It's gone tenfold how important gaming is at that point. But for me, it's just a feeder into the real world. Otherwise, we're all going to be sat in our bedrooms, you know, playing games and never go out and see the Goodwoods and the Le Mans of this world.
Yeah. Darren, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. We seem to have covered everything from Dan Gurney to Mr. Blobby to Porsche 956s to Manchester City football, eSport. We've really done well, I'd say, in the last hour or so. Obviously, you're welcome back anytime. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you as well, Jack, for filling in those huge gaps in my own knowledge on sports car racing. Hopefully, we've demystified it a little bit for you. And thanks, as ever, to Alan for recording us and making us all sound great. Tune in. There's a number of things happening with the Motorsport magazine brand at the moment. We've launched a new series of YouTube films, How to Drive, which actually features Dickie Meaden slithering and sliding cars around, having fun.
I definitely need to watch that.
Oh, they're great. Yeah, there's some cool stuff coming up as well. And obviously more podcasts to follow. Thanks for listening to this podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz, and we will see you next time.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched, something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used. But not what you're used to.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.